Hi, everybody. My name is Glenn Royster, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Charlie before I get off on some tangent for allowing me to participate here this evening. It's a privilege for me to just to attend a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this meeting in particular, this is a very special meeting for me. There may be some confusion. I told you my name is Glenn. I should clear up that. There may be some confusion surrounding that. If you've ever been to a meeting in Northern California, where I'm from, you may have heard some people call me by a different name. My real name is Grenville, which may give you some idea why I drank the way I did. I have had the privilege of attending this group many, many times, and my friend Johnny H., for some reason, keeps introducing me as Gene. I haven't any idea in the world why Johnny calls me Gene. It's okay with me. He's been sober longer than I have, and I guess he can call me anything he likes. And besides that, your name is Brenda. Gene don't sound too bad, does it? However, on the other hand, after knowing me over a quarter of a century and having been sober almost 34 years, wouldn't you think God'd be well enough to get your name right? I know I'm going to pay dearly for that, but somewhere down the line, I'm from up north. I live in Walnut Creek, California, and I'd like to bring you greetings and salutations from Alcoholics Anonymous Nursery Group Number 3 in Walnut Creek, California. That's my home group, and they're right about in the middle of the meeting right now, and I think it's one of the best groups on the face of the earth. I've lived in Northern California for the last few years. For a number of years of my sobriety, I lived in Oregon. And I don't know if anyone else here can identify with this, but I'm just a little bit sensitive. And when I was living up there, a friend of mine invited me to come down to Sacramento and talk at a Saturday night meeting. And when I got there, it turned out it was one of those AA clique groups. If you know what an AA clique is, it's an AA clique is when there's two or more people gathered in an AA meeting and they're not talking about me, you're a clique. And, there was a couple hundred people there, and I sat in the front of the room and just kind of sat there and withered for a while. And I used to say that I had a hearing problem, and my sponsor changed that a few years ago. He said, "I hear fine, I don't listen too well." And that's true. And as I sat in the front of the room thinking of myself, I could hear two ladies in the back of the room. They must have been probably 8 or 10 rows back. And one lady said to the other, "Do you know who the speaker is tonight?" And the second said, "Some hick from Oregon." I imagine someone may have said that here tonight, huh? Well, anyway, ever since that evening, I've taken great pains to point out that I am not a hick from Oregon. I happened to live in Oregon for a while. I'm a hick from New York State. And I probably didn't have to tell you that. It's fairly recognizable. Someone once said you can take the boy off the farm, but you can't take the farm out of the boy. And I would like to blame my parents, or I'd like to have some generic reason for me drinking the way I drank and doing the things I did, but I can't find any history of alcoholism in my family. My parents treated me just fine. They loved me very much. I was my parents' favorite child. Of course, I was my parents' only child. That may have had something to do with that, too. I grew up on a little country road up in the Finger Lakes region in New York. It was a gorgeous place, but I didn't think so when I was a kid growing up. I went to the same school my mom went to, and I grew up in the same house my mother and my granddad grew up in. I can't blame anything for that. I've been rather upset because I don't really get a chance at blaming other people in my family. I'm an only child of only children, and that don't really sound fair, does it? I mean, I have no cousins or relatives that I can blame for my alcoholism. Of course, I didn't have many to choose from. That may have had something to do with it. I should have had a real great childhood, but I don't remember it that way. And I was listening to Sharon speak, her friend speak up here early, and she said she wasn't well liked when she was a child. And for many years, that's the way I perceived myself. I didn't think that I was well liked in school or after I got out of school. I always perceived myself as being outside. A few years ago, I was fortunate enough to go back east, and I struck up a relationship with a fellow across the road that's been my best friend since I was a kid. We've known each other for almost 60 years. And we went to high school and grade school and elementary school together. And a few years ago, we were talking, and he perceives my childhood as entirely different than I do. Of course, David's not an alcoholic. David perceives our childhood as me being very popular in school. And that's not the way I remember it. I just remember my childhood as I never fit in, I never belonged, I never felt a part of. I never really felt like I was one of. And the first time I ever really felt comfortable in my life was the night I took a drink of alcohol for the very first time. I was on a date, and it was my first date I'd ever had. I was a junior in high school, and a gal asked me to if I'd take her to this dance. And there was a couple sitting around a table, and they ordered a thing called a rum coke, and I didn't really want to have a drink that night. I thought of myself as being a jock, but I wanted to be part of the gang, so I ordered a rum coke too, and I took a slug of that stuff, and I don't know how much I drank. Maybe I drank half of it, maybe I drank all of it, I don't remember. But I do remember somewhere during the course of that night, I'd never felt like that before in my life, because all of a sudden, somewhere during the middle of that evening, I felt like I belonged. I felt like I was a part of it, and I asked the girl to dance, and they tell me later the next day I had a wonderful time. And that's the way the next 14 years went for me. I was a blackout drinker. I was a morning drinker. I started drinking in mornings by the time I was 19 years old, and I'd drink anything I could get my hands on. Somewhere along the line, about the time I was 18 or 19, I knew there was something wrong with the way I felt. There was something wrong down in here, and I hadn't the faintest idea what it was. And during the next 10 years or so, I tried many of the things that's outlined in Chapter 3 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I did one other thing, too. Starting at about 18 or 19, I start joining religions. I joined different churches. I've been dipped in and dragged through and sprinkled on most of the great baptismals of this world. And when I was 19 years old and being dragged across that baptismal, I found a girl came with it. That's another story. But anyway, we were married shortly after that. And Phyllis and I were married about 10 years, and we lived together about 6. And during that first 6 years, just towards the end of that first 6 years, just before our fifth child was born, I went out one night to get a drink. We had some argument over something, and I didn't get home for 3 years. Our marriage, I don't remember an awful lot about our marriage. We must have been some good things. We had 5 children, and in the time span from when the first child was born until the fifth child was 5 years, 6 months, and 8 days. We were busy people. And when I did get home, I had just been released from a treatment facility. Well, they didn't call it a treatment facility in those days. They called it a penitentiary. I know there'll be some people that will take exception to me comparing a treatment facility to a penitentiary, but I suggest for your consideration they don't put normal, well-adjusted people in either of those locations. I ended up in a place called Elmira Reformatory when I was 27 years old, and I'd been there maybe 2 months, and I was walking across the yard, and I seen a Catholic priest come at me. I'd seen this fellow before. I'd grown up behind his parish in my hometown. He was the chaplain of this institution. And he had taught my wife in high school. And if I seemed just a little strange, or a little more nervous than I should be, maybe it has something to do with my relationship with him, because I was 12-stepped by this Catholic priest in that yard at that penitentiary. Now, I know it's not too unusual for alcoholics to be 12-step by Catholic priests. God knows there's a lot of them in the program. However, this guy wasn't in the program. He was a member of Al-Anon. And he was also a Jesuit Catholic priest. And if any of you know anything about Catholicism, they're sort of like the Nazi stormtroopers of the Catholic Church. He not only was a Jesuit Catholic priest, he was a member of Al-Anon. I was in that penitentiary for robbing a Catholic church. And I don't say that with a great deal of pride. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of things I'm not proud of. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not ashamed of who I am. And this fellow, this Catholic priest, his name is Father Jim, he came across the yard and he said to me, "Loister, I'd like to talk to you sometime if you'd like to talk to me." Now, I didn't really want to talk to this guy. But while I was waiting in the county jail, I got some very good advice. And one of those things was to join everything in sight when I got there because it looked good on my record when I came up for parole. And I kind of equated that with talking with this Catholic priest, so I put a requisition in to go see him. And I just knew that Bishop Sheen, who was the bishop of the Rochester Diocese, had called Father Collins and told him that poor Bach Stephen Loister is in your penitentiary, get the SOB. But he didn't. He talked to me about some mutual friends we had. And then very casually he said to me, "Loister, do you have any idea why you're here?" And I mumbled some stuff about some charges that I had had. Then in the lowest possible tones I could muster, I mentioned St. Mary's Catholic Church and the poor boxes. And this guy went into hysterics. And he said something to the effect that if I got my booze out of the money in the Catholic poor box, I must have drank off of cheap wine. And he reached in his drawer and he pulled out a little file he found someplace that someone had gave him or something. And it was my file. And I don't know how many arrests I had. I suppose it was 18 or 20. I haven't the faintest idea. But he went on to tell me that on each one of the arrest records that I had, the arresting officer had always noted that I appeared to be under the influence of alcohol. And he explained to me that at that time at this penitentiary, there wasn't any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. The warden of this penitentiary didn't believe that anyone under the age of 30 could be an alcoholic. And you had to be under the age of 30 to be sentenced to this place. You see, I was a failure at everything I did prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a failure as a son, and I was a failure as a husband, and I was a failure as a father, I was a failure as an employee, I was a failure as a friend, I was even a failure as a thief. I couldn't get sentenced to a penitentiary. I had ended up in this little reformatory. And this warden did not believe that anyone under the age of 30 could be an alcoholic, so up to that period of time, he hadn't allowed any meetings to be held there. But Father Collins told me that he had contacted the governor and pleaded his case to have meetings held there, and he was sure that in the very near future, AA meetings would be held there. This was sometime in January of 1962, I guess. And a couple weeks after my conversation with Father Collins, Governor Rockefeller sent a telegram to Warden Weaver at Elmira, ordering him to allow meetings to be held at this institution. And the warden, Father Collins, had told me, had said over his dead body, would he allow that? And while he was reading this telegram from the governor, Warden Weaver had a heart attack and died. They say you don't get that well that quick, and frankly, there's still a warm spot in my heart when I think of that, somehow. I attended meetings at the institution for quite a while, and there was a couple guys from the street, just like you guys here, that used to bring the meetings into us every Tuesday afternoon. And I'm very grateful for hospital and institution committees, because if it wasn't for hospital and institution committees, I don't know if I would ever found Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't find anything in me that's special whatsoever. I know a lot of people that I have met over the last 30 years who are more deserving of this thing called sobriety than I, that have never been able to get this thing called sobriety. And I'm sure that God don't love me any more than he does any other person on the face of the earth. It appears to me that possibly The reason that I was able to find Alcoholics Anonymous in this thing called sobriety was because someone was grateful enough for their sobriety that they took the time out of their busy day to bring it into this penitentiary. And I'm very grateful for that. And I, while I attended meetings there, I was even secretary of the group for a while, but I didn't stay sober. I ended up a year or so later living in a Greyhound bus depot, drinking wine out of little cheap brown paper bags. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and had my last drink or mind-altering substance on December 29th, 1963. And the reason I give my sobriety date is because I'd like the newcomer to know that Alcoholics Anonymous works. I don't know how long it works for, but I know that it works for something over 30 years because I haven't had a drink of alcohol or mind-altering substance in that period of time. And I was on parole at the time, and I was back in my hometown, and I was at a meeting Friday night up in the Bay Area, and there was a lady that talked, and she went on in great detail about how she's seen sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous every day of her life in places other than meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, how there were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous on every street corner and every facet of life. Well, 30 years ago, it wasn't that way. And the town that I got sober in, there was two meetings a week on Tuesdays and Friday nights, and there was maybe 12 or 14 people attended those meetings on any given week. Maybe 7 or 8 of them had any amount of sobriety. And that's all the Alcoholics Anonymous I knew for the first year or so that I got sober. I wasn't allowed to leave the county because I was on parole. And I started attending meetings in my hometown. The first night I got there, my parole officer had arranged for me to sleep on the sofa at my rapidly becoming ex-wife's house. And when I got there, I had been sober about 4 weeks. And I told Phyllis that I, even though I'd been gone something over 3 years, I was now a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And boy, wasn't she impressed. And the first night I was there, I looked in our phone directory, and there was no listing in that town for Alcoholics Anonymous. And this wasn't ancient years ago. This was 1963, December of 1963. Not all that long ago. So I went out to a public telephone because I didn't want anyone in the house or my children to hear that I might be calling Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a pay phone, and I called information, and I asked the operator if she had a listing for AA. You see, I was a rather important person, and I couldn't ask for the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This was a town of about 35,000 people, and I hadn't been there in 3 years, and I was worried about my anonymity. I at one time had been a fairly decent athlete and had a lot of print, newsprint around concerning my name, and I'd also had a lot of newsprint concerning the fact that I was arrested on a number of occasions. However, I didn't want anybody to know that I had a drinking problem. So I asked the operator for the number of AA, and she gave me a number, and I called it, and I got the Automobile Club of America, Auburn, New York. So I summered up all the courage and faith I could, and I called information back, and I asked the operator for the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a different operator. It was a lady. And she said, "Is this Glenn Loister?" I'll tell you how sick a cookie I was. I never thought to try to find out who that was for about a year. But I said, "Yes, it is." And she told me there wasn't any listing for Alcoholics Anonymous, but there was a guy that lived in a little town some 5 or 6 miles from there that she knew that hadn't had a drink in 15 years. His name was Sam, and she gave me Sam's telephone number. And she was sure if Sam didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous, he could tell me where I could find it. And I called Sam up, and it happened to be a Wednesday afternoon, early evening, and Sam told me there were meetings there on Tuesdays and Fridays, and would I like someone to come over and talk to me? And I had way too much pride for that. I said no, I was all right. I was dying a million deaths, and there was a hole inside me that the wind was blowing through that alcohol no longer could fill up, or I would have took a drink that afternoon. Booze had stopped doing for me sometime before that what I'd done once. It had taken that hurt away, that feeling of being different, and I hadn't done that for a long time. All I'd been able to do was drink for oblivion. And I waited till Friday night, and I started attending these meetings. And I don't know how long I went to the meetings feeling the way I felt, I do know there was the same people there. Sam was there every week, and there was a guy named Mike. And at the time I was working on welfare in the state of New York. If you wanted to get welfare, you had to work if they had a job for you. And I was working for the Department of Public Works in my hometown 4 days a week. I'm looking for a job on the 5th, and attending these meetings on Tuesdays and Friday nights. And I probably wanted to drink. That was probably the most miserable period of my life, because I knew you had something, and I hadn't the faintest idea of what it was. And I was just not drinking a day at a time, and it was killing me. And there was this guy, Mike, that used to come to every meeting I went to. And I even seen him during the course of the week as I would be shoveling snow for the Department of Public Works. Mike would drive by in his beautiful, warm 1956 Chevy station wagon and blow the horn. And when I'd look at him, he'd kind of wave and show me all 32 of his pearly white teeth and bop on down the street. And I'd see him on Tuesdays and Friday nights at the A meeting. And after the meeting was over, he'd always come right across the room to me. We used to sit in a little semicircle. It was a participation meeting. And he'd say to me, "How's it going?" And he knew how it was going. It was going awful. That's how it was going. And I'd tell him how it was going. I'm trying to clean up my language now, or I'd tell you how it was going. And it was going awful. And I'd stomp out of that meeting, and I'd whip home. And I lived a couple miles from the meeting. And I would have went someplace else if I thought I could find something someplace else. But I tried everything else, and I knew Alcoholics Anonymous was the last house on the end of the block for me, and this was a dead-end street. And booze wouldn't do for me what it had once done for me. As I mentioned, all I could do was drink for oblivion, so I had no other choice except to blow my brains out or come back to that meeting. And so I kept coming back to that meeting on Tuesdays and Friday nights. And after what it seemed to me to be a period of eternity, but it was probably like 5 or 6 weeks, after a Friday night meeting, Mike came over and he asked me if I would like to have a cup of coffee at Hunter's Diner after the meeting was over with. And I had way too much pride to be seen in a coffee shop with some alcoholic Irish dude. And I told Mike that I was real tired and I wanted to get home. And he offered to give me a ride home. And I said to Mike, "Nah, Mike, I live way the other side of town out in Malone Village." And he said, "I know exactly where you live. I live right across the street from you." And he said an amazing thing after that. He said to me, "I suppose you want to know why I haven't asked you to ride before." And before I could answer the question, he said, "It's because I wanted to see how bad you wanted this." And we went on down to the coffee shop, and we sat there for, I haven't the faintest idea how long. And I had talked to a lot of people in the prior 14 or so years concerning my drinking. I have talked to some very nice people, a whole bunch of policemen and judges and attorneys and priests and ministers and rabbis, and they always talked about my drinking. And everyone had always said to me, or at least I had heard everyone say to me, "Loyster, if you just wouldn't drink so much, you'd be okay." And I knew that wasn't true. I knew that wasn't true, because most of the time when they were talking to me, I was stone cold sober and I wasn't okay. And many of the times I did some of the things I described earlier, like rob churches and people, and I did that stone cold sober. And I knew I wasn't going to be okay if I just didn't take a drink. And when I went out with Mike, I assumed on the way out it'd just be another night like that. And Mike did all the talking that night, but he never talked about me. He talked about himself. In essence, what Mike said was he told me what he'd been like and what happened and what he was like now. And for the first time in my life, I came to believe there was somebody that had the same feelings and the emotions that I did. I knew there was somebody just like me, and I'd never known that before. I had thought that I was different. I never knew anybody felt the way I felt. And I start hanging around Mike. And earlier I said that I was particularly happy to be at this group. One of my character defects, and it's one of my smaller ones, but nevertheless a character defect, I'm a hero worshiper. And for the last 30-odd years, all my heroes have been sober, active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a whole bunch of them are here in the room tonight. And Mike became one of my heroes. I started following Mike around. He started got me involved in the steps. But I knew sobriety wasn't going to be all peaches and cream right from the very beginning. My marriage split up and we got a divorce and we had these 5 children. And I had finally got a job. One of the requirements Mike had was that I get a job. And I had to take any job that was offered to me, or the first job that was offered to me. And The first job that was offered to me after about 5 months of sobriety was working at a John Deere dealership, putting together used farm machinery and steam cleaning used manure spreaders. That doesn't pay well, but it's really good for the ego, I'll tell you. And I was making something like $63.10 a week net, and my child support payments were $70 a week net. And I told Mike, I said, "Geez, Mike, I just can't take this job. It only pays $63. Mike said, "How much are you earning now?" And I said, "Nothing. I'm on welfare." And he said, "It sounds like a slam dunk to me. Take the job." So I took the job. And I was, after a couple of years, I got a little bit better job. And one day I was down at my wife's house seeing the children. It was in the summer. I'll never forget it. And I was peeking on Cloud 9 in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I left the house, my youngest son, who was probably 8 or 9 years old, or my oldest son was 8 or 9 years old at the time. His name is John. He's a little carrot, red-headed kid. He was sitting out at the curb all by himself. And as I went to walk down the street, he said, "Hey, Dad, can I see you a minute?" And I said, "Sure." And I walked on over, and he said, "Dad, can I ask you a question?" And I thought it was going to be some deep philosophical thing, and I said, "Yeah, sure, what can I do for you, John?" And he said, "Dad, have you ever been in prison?" That was a long time ago, and I can remember the hurt in his eyes when I had to answer yes. And I had no idea, and I thought it would be an impossible task for me to ever do anything that could remove that hurt I seen there that day. And I went right over to Mike's house. He lived close by, and Mike told him, "The only thing you can do is be the best father you can today, and don't take a drink a day at a time." And I tried to do that. Mike explained to me, I had to ask Mike a little bit earlier what the principles were that they're talking about in the 12th step. And Mike told me, that was his experience, that you had to work the 12 steps in order to be aware of what the principles are of the 12 steps, and it was impossible to tell anybody what those principles were. He went on to say, however, in my case, he would make an exception. And he thought maybe one of the principles might be making my child support payments on time. One of the principles might be getting a job and becoming self-supporting through my own contributions. And I tried to do that. And I was talking to somebody the other day, you know, and there seems to be a lot of talk about the symptoms of alcoholism today. You hear a lot of stuff around meetings from place to place. There's one symptom that men alcoholics seem to have, or men alcoholics of my kind, that I don't hear a lot of talk about. I don't know whether it's a symptom or just a condition. And I don't know whether anybody else can identify with this, but it's my experience that alcoholics, men alcoholics of my kind, women will draw us further than gunpowder will blow us. And I was sitting around this A meeting back east, one Friday night, and a lady came through from Anaheim, California, and she had 8 or 9 years sobriety. And the next thing I knew, I was married living in Anaheim, California. And as it turned out, after living here for a couple of years, she had a little problem with prescription medication, and I decided that maybe I could do something about that, so I decided we ought to take a geographical cure. And it was during that period I got out to move to California. I was really not that active in alcohol. I was going to meetings, but the best way to describe what was happening to me, there was a guy around the AA that a lot of people have heard about. His name is Father John Doe, Ralph Fowle, and one of his writings, he talked about people like me at that period of my sobriety. He said that people like me just come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we sit in the back of the room waiting for something spiritual and mystical to happen to us. And while we're sitting there, something is happening to us. Rigor mortis is setting in and we're dying. And that's what was happening to me during that period of my life. And we took this geographic cure. I knew a fellow that lived in Reno, and I thought he could straighten my wife out. So he moved up there, and somehow or other we ended up in Eugene, Oregon a couple weeks later. Alcoholics, it's my experience, that tend to do stuff like that. And while I was in Eugene, I got a new sponsor, and I hit a particular bottom where I had to make a decision whether I was going to have to do something with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. besides just go to meetings and not drink, which I've been doing. And I was at a meeting after I'd been there a couple, 3 weeks, and there was a guy I had noticed around town. I'd seen him at every meeting I went to. His name was Jack, and I'd had my eye on Jack. And I'd read in the big book someplace where, in page 82, where it talks about the promises, or 83, the promises that's outlined, and one of the promises about being in, knowing intuitively what to do in certain situations where we had been bewildered before. And this one night I was sitting at this meeting just before the meeting, and Jack came in, and he'd just been on a 12-step call. And Jack went on an awful lot of 12-step calls then and still does today. And the fellow he'd taken with him, and he usually had taken a newcomer with him if he could, or at least he always went on a 12-step call with somebody. This guy was hysterical, the newcomer was, and he came over and sat down with me, and I asked him what he was hysterical about, and it seems this guy had never been on a 12-step call before, and Jack asked him to go with him, and on the way Jack said to him, "We'll Mutt and Jeff him when we get there." And Roy said to Jack, "What do you mean?" And Jack said, "Well, you be the nice guy and I'll be tough guy." And Roy said he didn't know any different, so they just walked up to the door, a place a fellow by the name of Ben had called and asked to see somebody for Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jack kind of waddled up to the door first and knocked on the door, and Ben opened the door, and he had a bottle of I.W. Harper in one hand and a 357 Magnum in the other hand. And without batting an eye, Jack turned around to Roy and said, "Roy, why don't you be the tough guy?" Roy told me that story. I went right across the room and asked Jack to be my sponsor because I want that kind of guy on my team. And that's been a fantastic relationship. I owe an awful lot of my sobriety to Jack. I don't believe I'd be here tonight if it wasn't for Jack. Jack not only walked me through the steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he allowed me to watch him practice the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got me involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple years ago, I began coming down here working in Southern California a lot, and I've been coming down here about a year and a half, and a couple of guys that I sponsor this spring, we were out having lunch, and they said, "You know, Glenn, you're spending a lot of time down in Southern California. That's great AA they got down there, but you're kind of doing that Nazi AA Southern California stuff. And up here in Northern California, we're a little bit more laid back than they are down south. And maybe you're getting a little bit too militant in your sobriety. You're hanging around with some guys that got some pretty tough militant type sobriety." And I told those guys that, number one, there was only one big book of Alcoholics Anonymous I knew. And two, if they thought some of the guys down here were militant, they ought to meet my sponsor. Jack, best describe Jack and how he treated me. Jack understands that I'm a very sensitive person. And I became very successful in business after I got to Oregon. I went into work for a fellow in Alcoholics Anonymous in the building materials trade in general, and particularly the roofing business. And through a series of events that I had no control over whatsoever, I became very successful. And I became quite aware of my success. And it was starting to take up a lot of my time. And I had a deal with Jack. Jack made a deal with me. When I asked him to be my sponsor, he said, "This is the way it works. We'll have lunch once a week at least. And how it works is you buy and I talk." And that's the way we still work it today. And this one day we were out having lunch, and I said, "You know, Jack," I said, "I'm getting awful busy in business, and I'm going to four or five meetings a week, and I'm involved in a couple other things here, and I probably ought to knock off some of that AA stuff because I should become more responsible in business." And we were in a crowded restaurant, and it was about 12:15. And Jack said to me, "If you do that, Glenn, what you'll be saying is, you're the most selfish SOB on the face of the earth. You've got yours through everybody else." And Jack didn't say it exactly that way, but I'm cleaning up a little bit. And that's exactly what I would have been saying, because I have got mine here at Alcoholics Anonymous. After I moved up to Oregon, my life started getting immensely better. It had nothing to do with where I was, with what I was doing with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those five children, at one period or another, they came out and visited me, and all of them came out and lived with me at one time. That young boy that asked me if I had ever been in prison came out and lived with me for a couple of years and worked for me. And as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to have take an active participant part in each one of their kids' life. And I know what it's like to hear those each one of those five kids say, "I love you, Dad." And as a matter of fact, those five children each have families of their very own. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've heard 11 different grandchildren say, "I love you, Grandpa." That little redheaded boy I mentioned earlier came out to visit me last fall, and he hung around with a couple guys that I sponsor. And after he'd gone back east, some 6 or 7 weeks later, he decided that he might have a problem with alcohol. And as of tonight, as of today, he has 10 months of sobriety. And 2 weeks from tonight, he's flying out and spending a weekend at a conference with me. That wouldn't have happened had it not been for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the most blessed person on the face of the earth, it's my opinion, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that I have did is Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only thing I seem to need is Alcoholics Anonymous, the program and the fellowship. And if you were to ask me tonight, outside of sobriety itself, what are the three things I'm most grateful for, I'd have to list the first thing is the fellowship, the people, you guys out there, because you were the first thing I seen when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Were it not for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program and the recovery would be just another theory. And the people, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the second thing I'm most grateful for, is the program of AA. While you people walked me through that program of recovery, I came to find a God of my very own. And that's the third thing I'm most grateful for this evening and at this point in my life. And I don't think God, as I understand him, would be upset that I put him third, because I wrap it all together. And I'd have to tell you tonight, Alcoholics Anonymous is more important to me than it was the day I got here. And the fellowship, if I had to tell you how important the fellowship is, I'd have to say it's the most important thing in my life, because I can't separate the program from the fellowship or God, as I understand him. It's all one route and package. And I'd like to thank you for listening to me, and I love you much.